Okay, so I'll spend the next hour talking about some basic systematics or semantics, as you want, on radiogenic isotopes and noble gases. And I'll try and deal more with the principles, and Stan is going to talk more about, on the lecture on Saturday, about how to put all this information together in talking about the reservoirs down in the mantle. So let me tell you first what I'm not going to talk about today, which is primarily going to be the uranium-thorium-lead systematics. And this actually is a little more complicated than some of the other radiogenic systems like rubidium-strontium or samarium-neodymium. But the basic idea in this equations are that you have three isotopes of lead, 206, 207, 208, which are produced by radioactive decay of uranium-238, uranium-235, and thorium-232. And you can fractionate these parent-daughter ratios, and therefore you can produce different 206-204 ratios in different mantle-derived materials. So if we start off from the very basic, we'll deal with two systems initially, rubidium-87 that decays to strontium-87 and samarium-147 that decays to 143-neodymium. This is sort of the very basic decay equation, where the rate of decay is simply proportional to the number of atoms you have if you solve this very simple differential equation. And if you reference your radiogenic daughter that's produced from this radioactive parent P, you get this relation where dr by ds today is equal to the initial dr by ds plus the parent-daughter ratio today multiplied by e to the lambda t. So again, these are in this blocks are what we measure in the labs today. And if you're interested in figuring out, for example, the crystallization age of a rock or something, you can very easily fit a straight line through the data, and the slope of that straight line is going to tell you about the time. But what we are more interested today is what the measurement of these dr by ds can tell us about the mantle and what kind of processing might have gone on in the mantle. Okay. There's some more terminology. Often you will see the use of the epsilon notation, and all that is the measured, for example, for neodymium, where 144 is the referencing stable daughter. The 143-144 ratio in the sample is normalized to a 143-144 in what's known as Coor or chondritic uniform reservoir. And what this is it essentially represents the evolution of a bulk Earth with a solar system SMND ratio and the initial 143-144 that equals that of other chondritic meteorites. So that's just a reference that's used. And so effectively, this is the epsilon neodymium is a deviation in parts per 10,000 from this reservoir. So if you remember from John's lecture in stable isotopes, you use the per mil notation, which is deviation in parts per 1,000. The epsilon notation is deviation in parts per 10,000. Okay. So we talked about this in the very first lecture about some partitioning, and Cinti has already set up this idea about how you can have fractionation of elements during melting processes. So the thing to remember is that samarium, neodymium, rubidium, strontium are all incompatible and lithophile elements, which means they're all silicate-loving, and which means that they will prefer a melt over a rock. There are some important points to make here, which is that during a melting event, it appears that rubidium prefers the crust or prefers the melt much more strongly than strontium does. And likewise, during melting, neodymium prefers the melt much more than samarium prefers it. So during such a melting event, you will end up with different rubidium strontium in the melt than you started off with, and likewise you end up with different samarium neodymium ratios than you start off with. So here's sort of the cartoon format. Let's say you have a parcel of mantle that melts partially, maybe up to 10%, and the melt ultimately goes and produces the crust, and the residue you can stick back into the mantle, and that might be a depleted reservoir. Now, you started off with the rubidium strontium in the mantle of a certain value. What happens is the melt has a higher rubidium strontium than the mantle, and the mantle, or the unmelted mantle, will have a higher rubidium strontium than the residue. The opposite is going to be true for samarium neodymium. So the melt will have a lower samarium neodymium than the mantle, and the residue will have the higher samarium neodymium. So in terms of an isotope plot, where this is time and this is increasing 87-86 ratios, let's call that the evolution of a bulk Earth. And let's say at some point in time, you produced a melting event. And during this melting event, you fractionated rubidium from strontium. And remember that 87, rubidium decays to 87 strontium, and since the crust has a higher RBSR ratio, this evolves very quickly to high radiogenic values. And likewise, because the residue has a lower RBSR ratio than the bulk mantle here, it does not evolve to very high 87-86 ratios. So the opposite, again, is going to be true for neodymium, which is, this is now, I think, it's slightly cut off. This is increasing 143-144 ratios, so the residue ends up at the high 143-144 ratio, and the crust, or the melt, has lower 143-144. And this very basic cartoon immediately tells you that you should see sort of a negative correlation between 87-86 and 143-144, because in one case, the crust has more radiogenic value, and the other case, the crust has less radiogenic values. Okay, so let's make this a little more complicated. So this is done on purpose, and so this sort of looks like the tree of life. And imagine now what you could do is, so initially we just had a simple melting event here, and you let the crust evolve in this direction, and you let the residue evolve in this direction. But at some other point, you could take this crust, and you can further melt it. So you imagine this is eclogite that you recycle back into the mantle, and then you partially melt it, and you let that melt again sit along for a very long time, then that melt evolves along this trajectory, the residue will evolve along that trajectory. And the basic idea is that through these multiple melting events, you can see you can generate a whole spectrum of isotope values. So for example, this might look depleted in certain trace elements, but in terms of its isotopic composition, it can still be higher than the bulk Earth. So this is actually what is known as a two-stage evolution, in which case you had a melting event here and a second melting event there. And if you sort of take this to its logical conclusion, we know that the mantle has been depleted continuously over time, and so you would have to come up with some sort of a continuous depletion model for the mantle. By the way, feel free to stop me at any time and ask questions. So this is... We'll go to the continuous evolution at some point, maybe in a few minutes. So this is the data, essentially from all across the different ocean basins from different ocean island basalts. This is 87, 86, 143, 144, and sure enough, there's this negative correlation. Just wanted to point out a couple of things. Turns out that most mid-ocean ridges are plotting along this segment here. There are a few scattered Indian morphs that are down here. These are different ocean island basalts. These are different flavors of ocean island basalts called EM1, EM2. And again, these end members are going to be dealt with in the lecture on Saturday that Stan is going to give. But from the point of view, you see that this is a pretty fat array, and you can define different regions of the mantle that have different compositions. FOSO is supposed to be sort of a less depleted mantle than an average mantle that mid-ocean rich basalts sample. So this is supposed to be the carrier of the high helium ratios. And there does seem to be, when you look at this figure, there does seem to be a difference in the composition of mid-ocean ridges and what are sampled by ocean island basalts. In general, mid-ocean ridges seem to be more depleted than some of these more enriched compositions down here. So the question is this really true, or is this sort of an artifact? So is this sort of gray curve clear to everybody, or okay? So if we sort of make a histogram of this, of the previous figure, the black line is now mid-ocean ridges. This is epsilon neodymium. So this direction indicates more depletion. This direction indicates enrichment. Okay. So this is the histogram for the mid-ocean rich basalts. This is the histogram for ocean island basalts. And there are two points that you should see here. One is that the mode of these two distributions are different. And the other is that the width is different. So for example, you see these these ocean island basalts effectively going on to much more enriched compositions than you see in mid-ocean rich basalts. So they sort of maybe go up to zero epsilon, but they don't really go out this far. So there might be a couple of ways of explaining this. One is to say, the y-axis, it's a normalized histogram. So this is just a frequency. So one explanation might be that ocean island basalts and MORBs are actually sampling two very distinct regions, or they're effectively integrating over parts of the mantle that have different compositions. The alternate view could be that this is simply representing length scales of heterogeneity, that maybe along mid-ocean ridges, you are sampling at a much larger length scale, and therefore you're homogenizing things much better, and therefore you never see these extreme compositions. On the other hand, in ocean island basalts, maybe you're sampling on very small length scales, and therefore you're seeing all these tiny little blobs, and therefore you're seeing all these very enriched compositions. I'm actually not sure if that's the real, if length scale is the only, or if length scale can really explain this. So if it's a length scale issue, then you should also be seeing these very depleted compositions that the mid-ocean ridges sample. So if you're just sampling tiny blobs, then you should see enriched compositions, but you should also see the more depleted compositions. As a matter of fact, you almost never see anything beyond this modal class for the MORBs that are being sampled in ocean island basalts. So I don't know how to really explain this with the sampling, length scale sampling. One possible way out is to say, well, what is really depleted down here under ocean island basalts for some reason never melt. So that never contribute to any melting under ocean island basalts. Maybe an explanation. I think this certainly needs to be explored in more detail to see if that's a possible explanation. So now let's try and figure out if we'll talk about a little more quantitatively about issues such as sampling length scale, what sort of features should give rise to these kinds of broad features. And we'll also talk about mixing time scales. So this was a model, sort of one of the latest box models that was done by Kellogg and Jacobson and Rick O'Connell in 2002. There are other box models that have been done by DiPaolo and Stein Jacobson in 83 and 88. So in this is a very simple model. It starts off sort of with three boxes, primitive or enriched mantle, a depleted mantle, and then a crust. And effectively what this is doing, this is taking a chunk of the mantle here, melting it, producing a melt and a residue, sticking the melt in the crust, sticking the residue back in the mantle, and then keeping track of all these different boxes. So essentially, you're starting off only with three boxes, but after like 4 billion years, you might have 400 different boxes. Because every time they're melting, they're creating a new residue in the melt. And then they're tracking both the length scales of these, so they're assuming that the shortest length scale is getting stretched over. By the way, if somebody's interested in the equations, I don't want to go into it because I want to cover a lot of other stuff. But the equations are derived in Kellogg 2002 and also the other two papers I showed for reference. And effectively, a four coupled differential equations, one dealing with the mass transport between the different reservoirs, one dealing with the conservation of the stable reference daughter here. The third equation deals with the radioactive daughter. And then the fourth equation deals with the decay product of this radioactive parent decays to this radioactive stable daughter here. So these are the four coupled differential equations that you need to solve. So what Kellogg was looking at was how you keep track of all these different reservoirs that you're creating and sticking back into the mantle. And every time he's melting something, he's creating new reservoirs, and then he's tracking the length scales. So there is a stirring time that is being defined in this model, and the stirring time is effectively the e-folding time for the shortest length scale of these heterogeneities. So if I say that the stirring time is 500 million years, it means that the length scale of the shortest axis has decreased by a factor of 1 over e. And then he's putting in a box. So he lets these run for about 4 billion years, and then he puts in a box defined by this length scale LS, and he just sees what he samples. And he does this 10,000 times up to 50,000 times and produces a distribution. So this is sort of maybe simulating what is happening in the real mantle, where you don't have a single composition that defines the entire upper mantle. The upper mantle is defined by some sort of a continuum of composition, and what you're really seeing at mid-ocean ridges is some average of that composition. So there are two things that actually come out of this kind of modeling. So in this case, so this is again a histogram showing that's a normalized frequency here. So this is the epsilon neodymium. And again, remember, this is going towards more depleted compositions. This is going towards more enriched composition. And this is the length scale of the sampling. And sure enough, intuitively you would expect this, but this is now quantified, that if you have a very large length scale of sampling, you get a very tight distribution. And then as the sampling length scale decreases, you start to see this broader and broader distribution. So to a zeroth order, this might be explaining what we see between the MORBs and the OIBs, that the MORBs have a much more tighter distribution, maybe because they're sampling on a much larger length scale. The OIBs might be sampling on a much shallower or a much shorter length scale, and therefore they have these more enriched compositions, a broader distribution. The reason why it's asymmetric is because the depleted mantle has very low concentrations of the elements. So even when you're sampling it, you actually don't see the effect of those depleted reservoirs. So these enriched reservoirs has most of the neodymium, and that's why it's sort of dominating the budget. So that's why it becomes asymmetric. That's right. Oh, sorry. I think it's just the other way around then. Sorry, it's just the other way around. It's been a while since I read the paper. But what struck me, and this might not be intuitive, is if you look at the bottom plot here. So this is now, so F is, by the way, the amount of melting that they're imposing. So this is about 0.5% melt. And this is, again, the normalized frequency, epsilon neodymium, and now they're defining what's known as the stirring time. And effectively, you see that as you increase the stirring time, the distribution becomes broader and broader. So for small stirring times, you have a very tight distribution. And this, initially to me at least, was not intuitive. It turns out the explanation is that if your stirring time is very small, you never get these really tiny heterogeneities, in which case these tiny heterogeneities can never dominate a chunk of the melt that you're sampling at the very surface. So you're always seeing only the really broad features in the mantle. And because you're only seeing the very broad features in the mantle, you never will see the most extreme compositions that's present in the mantle. So only when you start to really stretch and thin out the heterogeneities can you almost sample them individually, and that's when you start to see these very broad features. So the stirring time here is being defined as the e-folding time for the length scale of the heterogeneity. So I think one could possibly define different the stirring time in a different fashion. This is just how they defined it. It's probably because it's 1 over, so I don't think I have the equations here. No, I don't. No, it's because it is 1 over E, I believe. So that's why the shorter the length scale, the less stretched it is. The shorter the stirring time, the less stretched it is. I think, so the question is, what is the effect of preferentially sampling some reservoirs? Because the different reservoirs might not be contributing to the melt in the proportions that they're present. And this is actually a shortcoming of this model. So let's say you have something that's very depleted, and let's say you have eclogite, which is a very fertile material. So if you have a 50-50 mixture of, say, a Hertzbergite and the eclogite, they're not going to melt in the same proportion. The eclogite is going to melt to a much larger extent, so the eclogite could dominate the melt. And that is shortcoming they actually discuss, and they say if you actually want to make some improvements to the model, you have to include a fertility function into these kinds of features. But the basic point that I want to show here is, so black is MORB, and sort of this gray is OIBs, and again, I think this is not clear. So the real OIB data scatter all the way up to here. And the MORB data is sort of scattering around here. So their model sort of captures the spectrum that we see in the MORB data. But it does not go anywhere near to the most extreme compositions down here that is seen in the real OIB data set. Again, it's not clear if this is sort of related to the fertility issue that Wong is mentioning. The point that I also want to make here is in this distribution, where they're capturing the MORB distribution, they're only depleting the upper third of the mantle. And they're effectively showing that just by depleting the upper third of the mantle, they can explain the entire MORB array. Does that really mean that only the upper third of the mantle is melted? Absolutely not. Because you can impose the fact that you may be depleted 80% of the mantle, and you would still be able to, I believe, capture this MORB Crensen. So I think the point with all these box models is they're really good at telling you or giving you intuition about certain processes. I don't think they're really good about telling you the truth. So you should treat box models from the point of view of maybe giving you some insight and maybe letting you know what are the important controls in the system. Okay, so let me spend the next half hour of the talk talking about noble gases and about helium. So there are two isotopes of helium, helium-3 and helium-4. Helium-3 is primordial, and helium-4 is produced by radioactive decay of uranium and thorium. This is the decay equation, and you notice that this is better written in terms of 4-3. You'll almost find not a single paper written which actually plots 4-3 ratios. They'll almost plot 3-4 ratios. I don't know why. I don't know if Stan knows the reason why they were started as 3-4 ratios. No clue? Okay. I have no clue either. We can blame Harmon Craig, okay. What we are really sure about is that helium behaves as an incompatible element, which means that it prefers melts over minerals. We are sure about this. We are not sure about whether helium is more incompatible than uranium and thorium during mantle melting. And that's kind of important, because depending upon this, 4-3 ratios might either indicate really old recycled material, or they might indicate primitive mantle. The standard view is that helium is expected, at least, to be more incompatible than uranium and thorium. So very low values of 4-3 or high values of 3-4 are expected to reflect less degassed mantle. The other point to keep in mind is that we can't really recycle helium back into the mantle from either the crust or the atmosphere. It diffuses out too fast as the temperature of the slab increases. So in some respect, if you look at the mantle as a whole, this ratio down here, this ratio is increasing continuously because you're sucking out helium-3 from the mantle continuously, but you're recycling uranium back into the mantle, but you're never recycling helium-3 back into the mantle. So over time, the bulk Earth uranium-helium ratio has to be increasing. So this plot is sort of showing you the consequence of assuming helium to be either more incompatible or less incompatible. The bottom plot is the standard view that's taken by a lot of noble gas geochemists. So this is the 4-3 ratio. So this indicates, in this direction, indicates less degassed mantle. This axis shows 3-4 ratios. So as you notice, anti-correlated. So high values of this reflects less degassed mantle. So the traditional view is, actually, I take it back. This is the traditional view. So this is the undegassed mantle. As you melt something, the residue will have a higher amount of uranium than the bulk earth. So therefore, the residue will ingrow helium-4, and therefore, this goes to very low 3-4 ratios. And I know that this is going to be a little confusing, and my apologies for that because of the switch between these two different axes. Does anybody have any preference of whether I should talk about 3-4 or 4-3? Maybe it might be better to stick to just one and not keep switching back and forth.
We're using the one where...
Okay, so that's this. Okay, so that's this axis then. So this is undegassed mantle evolving towards something like 50 times atmospheric ratios. And if you melt it, this is showing the evolution of the crust to very low 3-4 ratios. This is showing you the evolution of the residual mantle also to low 3-4 ratios. In this classical view, high 3-4 ratios indicate undegassed mantle. Anything that has been processed will have low 3-4. So this is a sort of the non-classical view, and this was put forth in about 2005 by Steve Parman and Mark Kurtz and Stan Hart, though I know that one of the authors of that paper disagreed with this view. That's not Stan, by the way. So in this... Sorry? I actually don't know his view. He agreed with this. Okay, so there was one dissenting view. So this is the anti-gas mantle here, and at some point you melt it. And in this case, what's happening is that the helium-3 is going into the melt preferentially over uranium, in which case the residue almost has no uranium in it. If it has no uranium, there is no radioactive decay of helium-4. So effectively in the residue, you're freezing the 3-4 ratio at the time that you're melting it. So if you have an old melting event, the residue will have a memory of what these anti-gas mantle 3-4 ratio was at that time. So in this scenario, if helium is preferentially extracted out of the mantle during a melting event compared to uranium, then the residue has high 3-4 ratios. And obviously this turns everything around on its head, because then you come back and say, OIB seem to be sampling this high 3-4 ratios, but this high 3-4 ratios indicate recycled material. Therefore, OIBs have no evidence of any primitive material in them. I think that this is still not the final word. I think we still need to figure out whether this is really true or not, whether helium is preferentially extracted out of the mantle during melting or not. This is a fundamental unknown, and it's actually shameful that we don't know really what they are. At the same time, these experiments are not trivial experiments. They are one of the most difficult experiments, and people have tried them for over 2 decades, and nobody has come up with a really bulletproof, to use Stan's words, bulletproof experiment to figure out the partition between helium and uranium. Okay, so let's first look at the helium isotope ratios in mid-ocean ridge basalts and in different basins. So typically when we report 3-4 ratios, we always normalize it to the atmospheric ratio. And the reason you normalize it, it's because of this really low number. So we don't want to keep referring to things like 2 times 10 to the minus 5. Instead, we say this is about 8 Ra, so it means it's 8 times the atmospheric ratio. So the point in this figure is that Pacific, Indian, North Atlantic, and South Atlantic all seem to be centered at around 8 times atmospheric. And the variance here seems to be different in the different ocean basins. So Pacific MOARP seems to have the lowest variance, and North Atlantic seems to have the highest variance. And just to point out that there appears to be no relation between isotopic composition and the spreading rate, but it turns out that the variance in this is actually inversely related to spreading rate. So one could possibly come out with two explanations. One is that if you have a fast spreading, you very efficiently mix material in the upper mantle and you homogenize everything, which is why, again, you're not going to see the extreme compositions. You're just going to see a very tight distribution. The others that was sort of put forth was that this somehow reflects differences in the degree of magma homogenization. So again, when you have fast spreading, maybe you're homogenizing magmas much better than when you have slow spreading. So this is a figure that Peter actually showed in his talk, showing the differences in helium isotopic composition now between mid-ocean ridges and the different ocean island basalts. So these are all the different ocean island basalts down here. And let's just look at this axis here. So this is low 3-4 ratios, high 3-4 ratios. This is sort of the average warp value of about 8 times atmospheric. Most of these ocean islands, such as Samoa, Galapagos, Hawaii, trend from values of about 8 Ra to very high ratios. The highest values that have now been measured are from Baffin Island, which is about 50 times atmospheric. And the other thing you notice is that there's a very large dispersion in the helium. So this appears that you see this dispersion not only in strontium and neodymium, but you also see it in the helium isotopic ratios. So MOARBs in general seem to be defining a smaller spread than some of these ocean island basalts here. So these are, in the traditional view, thought to represent some addition of, maybe primitive is the wrong word, but less degas mantle. The other set of ocean island basalts, which are known as HIMU, These are supposed to be from recycled crust. They have lower 3-4 ratios. And that's to our zeroth order, it makes sense, because when you recycle a slab, you strip off all the helium-3 and the helium-4 from the slab, but you don't strip out all the uranium from the slab. So radiogenic ingrowth in that slab is then going to lead to very low 3-4 ratios. So the fact that these islands have low 3-4 ratios from this figure appears to be consistent with the addition of recycled material. Now, if you remember John's talk from a couple days ago where he showed that HIMU actually does not, based on oxygen isotope, does not seem to have a very strong signature of recycled material. And that's because anything that has come up to the surface usually have a heavy oxygen isotope signatures. These HIMU basalts don't seem to have that characteristic signature of low temperature alteration. And I'll come back to the HIMU a little bit later. So if you compile the histogram for the different OIBs, you come up with a distribution that looks something like this. So this is the frequency distribution, this is 3-4 ratios, and you sort of see two different peaks. One is centered about 8 RA, which is the characteristic value that we know for mid-ocean ridges. So this is telling you very clearly that there is mid-ocean ridge volcanism that is associated at least with mid-ocean ridge sources that are associated with ocean island basalt volcanism as well. There appears to be somewhat of maybe, and this is not completely clear, but there appears to be a second peak that's centered at about 15 times atmospheric value. The important point is it is not centered at a very high 3-4 ratios. So OIBs don't have sort of this bimodal distribution whereby the helium is dominated by something that's very helium-rich with very high 3-4 ratios mixing with MORBs. So they have a very long tail down to these high 3-4 ratios, but these high 3-4 ratios are actually very, very uncommon. You will actually maybe have a handful, maybe 10 or 15 samples that plot in this space here. You'll have a much higher number of samples that are plotting in this region. So the exact meaning of that is unclear, but it might be reflecting something of a mixing between mid-ocean ridge sources and maybe just a little bit of addition of this more or less degas mantle. Based on the last two slides, I think you can come up with some first order conclusion, which is that the MORB source appears to be pretty well mixed, and it is probably more degassed than the OIB source, which is also a lot more heterogeneous. And this is consistent with the strontium and the neodymium data, which shows that OIBs also are more heterogeneous than MORBs. Okay, let's talk a little bit about neon, which also puts some really good constraints on the idea of whether there are primitive reservoirs in the mantle or not. So neon now has 3 isotopes, so every time we introduce an isotopic system, you'll notice that the level of complexity keeps going up. So neon now has 3 isotopes, neon 20, neon 21, and neon 22. So 20 is primordial, it's never produced in the mantle. First order, there is almost no neon 22 produced in the mantle as well. There is this reaction where you have an alpha particle interacting with fluorine producing neon 22, but the fluorine abundance in the mantle is very, very low. So you can sort of cross out this reaction as being important in the mantle. So for all effective purposes, nothing in the mantle can change the 20-22 ratio. So it was set by the accretion process, and it has not changed since then. 21 is a different story. And that's because uranium decay produces alpha particles. And the alpha particles interact with oxygen, splits out a neutron, produces neon 21. Likewise, we have uranium fission, which will produce neutrons. And those neutrons can interact with the magnesium, spit out an alpha particle, and produce neon 21. And these two equations, or these two reactions, actually indicate that the production of helium-4 is coupled to the production of neon 21. Through consuming alphas as well as through producing alphas. And the 21-4 production ratio is something like 10 to the minus 7. So obviously there is a lot more helium-4 being produced in the mantle than neon 21. But if we say that neon is expected, again, to be more incompatible than uranium and thorium during mantle melting, then you would say that low 21-22 ratios would reflect less degas mantle. So if we sort of take the standard view, is there evidence that OIBs are actually sampling something that's less degassed? So the helium seems to be indicating it's sampling something less degassed. Let's see if the neon indicates it's sampling something less degassed. So this is a typical neon three-isotope plot. So on the y-axis, you plot 20-22 ratios. X-axis, you plot 21-22 ratios. Again, remember, you can't really move up and down in this direction in the mantle. Air composition plots here. Now, the reason you see all these, the vertical direction is because every sample that we measure actually has a fair bit of air that has been added to it. So that's why you sort of see this motion in the y direction. But the real mantle plots somewhere about here. It depends on what the exact composition of the mantle was when the Earth formed. So if it was exactly solar, the 20-22 ratio would be somewhere up here, corresponding to about 13.5. But that's not important for the time being. The point is that if you have less degassed mantle, it should have low 21-22. So that's this direction. If you have more degassed mantle, you should have high 21-22, so moving in this direction. This is the composition of MORBS plotting on this line, which indicates that MORBS are being derived from something that sits here, and that little bit of air has been added to it. So the MORB composition is up here. If you look at Iceland and Louihi, which are the two classic plumes, they plot up here, much lower 21-22 ratios. So this at least is still consistent with the helium story, that the Iceland and Louihi regions are tapping something that has not been processed as much as the MORB regions. Now, interestingly, you'll notice that the Iceland and Louihi and Reunion and Kerguelen, they don't have the same 21-22 composition. They have different 21-22 compositions, and you can come up with two possible explanations. One is that there is only one reservoir in the Earth's mantle with this low 21-22, and the fact that they're mixing with different 21-22 indicates just a different amount of MORB addition to the sources of volcanism. Alternatively, you can say that different parts of the mantle have been processed to much different degrees. So Kerguelen is tapping a reservoir that has been less processed than MORB, but has been more processed than what's coming up at Iceland and Louihi. And really, the way to answer this is to couple the 21-22 to other radiogenic isotopes like strontium and neodymium to see if these variations in 21-22 are coupled also to variations in strontium or not. Now, I'll show later that there are a lot of data that have produced primarily in the last 15 years that couple helium to all the other radiogenic systems. By the time you go down to neon, there are actually very few measurements that have neon and strontium and lead and neodymium. So at this point, I don't think we can get a clear answer as to whether this is just reflecting different amounts of addition of MORB material or whether they're reflecting different degrees of processing of a single reservoir. So the question is, you know, is this an analytical? So this is air contamination. So is this an analytical issue, something that's happening in the lab, or is this a real process? And that's a good question, and we really don't know. So we know that when these lavas are erupted, they assimilate seawater. So that's one mechanism whereby you're going to introduce air ratios into the melt. We also know that it's possible to maybe get seawater down into the magma chamber, and assimilation there is also going to produce this kinds of trends. But nobody really knows where this air contamination is happening. There are ways of sort of reducing it, and so one reason why there's a lot fewer data points when you look at neon versus helium, which is you have to load your samples in vacuum chambers, bake them, and then let it sit around in the vacuum chambers for maybe 2 days, maybe 3 days, depending upon how precise you want the measurements to be. And so it takes a much longer time to make these measurements than it would take helium. So for example, most labs could presumably make something like 5 to 6 helium measurements in a day. Most labs would maybe make 3 or 4 neon measurements in a week. So, and then by the time you go into argon and xenon, that's time scales keep going up and up. So for xenon, you might make one measurement in 2 weeks or something like that. Cynthia. Mm-hmm. Yes, it has. So, you can see that the highest measured 3-4 ratios are in Iceland. Luihi has lower 3-4 ratios. Reunion is something like 15, 16. Kerguelen has slightly lower 3-4 ratios than Reunion. So this is, there's a correlation, but at the same time, that could also be meaning that there is more morb in the Kerguelen source than in the Iceland source. And I think you really want to look at the other isotope systems before firmly drawing a conclusion. So I wanted to talk about these Haimu basalts and why they have low 3-4 ratios. And as I said, John showed that based on the oxygen, it does not appear that the Haimus are being derived primarily from the oceanic crust, because you don't see the oxygen signature, and oxygen is a major element. So if the 3-4 ratios in these Haimu basalts are low, but actually it's kind of surprising that it's not down here, that it's not something like 0.01, because you're not actually putting any helium-3 back into the mantle. So there have been two explanations as to why these Haimu basalts are only a little more radiogenic than the morb ratios of about 8. And the explanation is that this is effectively diffusing, so there's a diffusive equilibration between the crust and the morb source, and that diffusive equilibration effectively pulls up these ratios from very low down to about values about 6 to 5 times atmospheric. If that is really an explanation, then we might be able to test this using neon, because neon is going to diffuse much slower than helium. So this is some recent measurements that we got in our lab. And again, these measurements are not made in basalt glass. They're made in olivines, and so therefore it's a little more difficult to make these measurements because, air contamination is an even bigger problem in olivines. So this is sort of this morb line down here. And what you notice are these Haimu basalts. These are from the Australs. Actually, you cannot say that they either plot on the morb line or actually they're deflected to the left. And if you remember, this is more radiogenic in this direction. So more radiogenic helium should also be associated with more radiogenic neon. So you should have expected these data points to actually fall to the right-hand side of the morb line. Instead, they all plot on the left-hand side of the morb line. So based on the neon, I don't think we're seeing a real strong signature of a recycled slab in the Haimu source. So there have been other possibilities that have been put forth for Haimu. One of them is that it's some sort of a metasomatized lithosphere. Now, if that's the case, that's, again, interesting from the helium point of view, because it is telling you that the partition coefficients, it's telling you something about the partition coefficients. So I go back to the slide. If this is recycled lithosphere, it's telling us that recycled lithosphere has lower helium-3 compared to uranium. So helium-3 is being preferentially extracted out. So it sort of doesn't support the view that Parman et al. Put forward. But that is only if we really believe that the Haimu basalts are coming from a recycled lithosphere. I don't know if Stan has an opinion as to whether or what the composition of the Haimu source is, and I think you're going to talk about it on Saturday, right? Okay, one last word about neon. And this is a paper that came out last year by Ballantyne. So remember that this is representing some sort of a mixture between air contamination and the real morb source that's somewhere up here. But this actually is not telling you where that real composition lies. It could lie anywhere along this line up to the solar value. So what Ballantyne did was something quite clever. They looked at these well gases from New Mexico. Now, the origin of these well gases are unclear, but they might be related to the rifting of the Rio Grande. And this is the data that they observe in these well gases. So it's reflecting some sort of a mixture between continental crust, which is very radiogenic in 21-22, and a morb signature. And they sort of see this kind of a mixing array. And what they said was, where these two arrays, where the morb line and this intersect, is the value of the convective mantle down here. So this immediately nails down where the convective mantle lies. This is about 12.2. Now, the highest measured value in the Iceland plume is somewhere about here, much higher than this value. And as I said, you can't really change 20-22 ratio in the mantle. So this might mean that there are two different and two distinct reservoirs in 2022, with the sort of the plume source having a higher 2022 than the morb source. And maybe the Moab source is a little bit lower than the plume source, because maybe it's possible just to add a little bit of air back into the mantle over time. So when I said that you can recycle neon back, maybe that's not completely true. Maybe you can recycle neon back just a little bit. But so that recycled neon signature doesn't show up in the plume source, but it might be showing up in the Moab source. Any questions, or everybody lost? They picked this, that's fair. So these are actually these data here, and these data here are from two different well gases. So they're not the same well gas. So they're two different wells, and they seem to be defining two slightly different trajectories. But I think Stan's point is well taken, which is this, how good is this? The other point is that it turns out that we actually have measurements of Moab samples from down here. So if I go back, we sort of, so that's an actual measurement at about 13. Okay? So how do you actually explain a measurement here if your composition is down there? Oh, that's Popping Rock. So for people that don't know, Popping Rock is this really gas-rich rock from the Mid-Atlantic, and they have the lowest amount of air contamination, and therefore they are supposed to represent the mantle source most closely. Okay. So just a little bit about argon. And again, for argon, we have three isotopes, 40, 38, 36. 36 and 38 are primordial, which means that they're not produced by any sort of radioactive decay in the mantle. Radioactive decay of potassium produces argon-40. And again, the assumption is that argon is more incompatible than potassium during mantle melting. And so high 40-36 will be reflective of less degas. High 40-36 is going to be reflective of more degas mantles. So you would expect MORBs to have very high 40-36. You should expect OIBs to have lower 40-36 ratio. Now, argon measurements are, again, very hard because there is 1% argon in the atmosphere, and argon is a pretty sticky gas. So for neon, atmospheric contamination was a problem. For argon, it's a severe problem. So this is a plot showing variations in 3-4 ratios versus variations in 40-36 ratio. And we don't have to worry about where all these data points come from. The point being that you have 3-4 ratios at about 30 times atmospheric, and the 40-36 ratio looks exactly like air. So this is a very strongly hyperbolic mixing. And likewise, sometimes you will have very high 40-36 ratios. So these are all the Popping Rocks that are down here, and they have MORB-like 3-4 ratios. So this is better shown in this figure. So this is the Popping Rock 40-36 ratio against 2022. And what you notice is that they sort of define this trajectory. And again, Moreira sort of did something clever. They said, we know that for argon, there's going to be pervasive atmospheric contamination. How can we really figure out what the true composition of the mantle is? This mixing trajectory is defining where the mantle composition lies, because we know that the Earth's mantle cannot exceed the solar 20-22 ratio. So all they did is was extrapolate this line to the solar value, and they get a 40-36 of about 44,000 or 45,000. For reference, air down here is 295. So what this is effectively telling us is that the MORB source saw very early extraction of argon-36 from its reservoir, and then subsequent decay of potassium generated very high 40-36 ratios. Now, if OIBs are really pristine material that has never been processed, then you would expect OIBs to have 40-36 ratios less radiogenic than air. So you would expect on this plot, you would expect OIBs to maybe lie somewhere down there. So where do the OIBs actually lie? So this is some of the scatter plot, but believe me that there are actual trends here. And this is the trend that has been observed for Iceland, which has also some of the highest helium-4 ratios. And if you, again, extrapolate this to 2022 of solar, you notice that the Iceland mantle has a 4036 that's about 8,000. So mid-ocean ridges are up here. Iceland samples are down here. So this is maybe consistent with the view that Iceland is tapping something that has been less degassed and less processed than what is coming out under mid-ocean ridges. But this is not consistent with the view that there is absolutely primitive chunk of material in the Earth's mantle that has never been processed. Because if that was the case, you would see correlations that go up in this direction. Correlations that would be in this direction. Because primitive material would have 40-36 ratios less than the atmospheric ratios. So I don't believe that there is anything in the mantle that has never been melted. And if you think for a second, that actually kind of makes sense. Because we know that the Earth went through some very traumatic differentiation events in the early part of its history. We know that the core was extracted. We know that there have been magma oceans. So nothing in the mantle should look exactly like chondritic. And so I think people get really worked up about whether you have something primitive in the mantle or not. I think a better question to ask is, are there reservoirs that have been less processed than the Moore reservoirs? And I think the answer to that is probably yes. Because the argon, the neon, and the helium are all consistent in that respect. They all seem to be saying that there's something that is not as degassed and not as processed as the Moore reservoir. But none of them actually indicate that it's pristine material. Okay, so just to summarize what I said, it appears that the MORBs are sort of more homogeneous compared to OIBs, and that it appears that OIBs are sampling a source that is less degassed than the mantle source. So let's look at some of the other isotope systematics and compare that to the noble gases. But before I do that, I wanted to take you through this exercise that Claude Alleg did maybe about 10 years ago, and this was used as a very strong argument for a layered mantle convection. And so here's the basic crux of the argument. The potassium content of the Earth, as derived from the potassium-uranium ratio in the MORBs, is about 250 to 285. That's for the bulk Earth. So you can calculate how much argon-40 has been produced over Earth history. And you come up with something like 140 times 10 to the 18 grams of argon-40. We know how much argon-40 is in the atmosphere. Argon has never been lost. We sort of have a good idea of where are the amount of argon-40 in the crust. So you can add these two and figure and subtract it from this number and figure out that there's something like 60 to 80 times 10 to the 18 grams of argon-40 in the mantle. So what do we really know about the amount of argon-40 that's in the mantle? And this is done primarily based on the amount of helium-4 that's believed to be coming up from the ridge and based on the helium-4 to argon-40 ratio in mid-ocean ridges. So if you know the helium-4 flux at ridge, if you know what the helium-4 to argon-40 ratio in MORBs is, you can calculate the argon-40 flux in terms of moles per year. And you can make some very crude estimates of the amount of oceanic lithosphere that is passing through these ridge systems. And to make a long story short, you come up with the fact that if the entire mantle looks like the mid-ocean ridges, then you have something like 1.4 to 1 times 8 times 10 to the 18 grams. You needed something like this, 63 to 81. So this is a lot lower than what is thought to be in the mantle. So this was one reason why Alleg put forward this idea of having a layering in between the upper and the lower mantle. So it turns out that if you think that this is representative, this number is representative of only the upper mantle, and if you stick 220 ppm in the entire lower mantle, you come up with 60 to 80 times 10 to the 18 grams. So it fortuitously happens that if this is exactly like a chondritic planet, then you have explained away sort of this argon paradox, that you have this hidden high argon-40 reservoir in the mantle. There are a couple of problems, and the problem is that the helium-4 flux at the ridge that is measured today, how representative is that of the history of the Earth? So you could imagine that the helium-4 flux could have varied significantly over time. So if everything is coupled to this helium-4 flux, you can see that if you increase the helium-4 flux at the ridge, you immediately increase the argon-40 flux at the ridges, which means that you immediately boost up this number. So this layering, I don't think, should be taken as should not be taken as evidence that you have layered mantle convection with the layering being at the upper mantle and the lower mantle. I think this argument actually presents some pretty good evidence that if the entire mantle down to the core mantle boundary looks like the MORB mantle, there might be a problem with explaining the total amount of argon that we see in the upper, in the MORB source and in the atmosphere. This, I think, makes a good argument that there might be a small reservoir with a high amount of argon-40. But because our estimates of the potassium content are not very accurate and because our estimates of the helium-4 flux might be off, I don't think you should take this as gospel. Okay, so in the last maybe 10 minutes or so, what I wanted to show you is the relation between helium and some of the other isotope systems and how they have been used to argue for a single reservoir, which might be pretty well defined in terms of its isotopic composition. So there are many such plots that have been made by many different workers in the field. So this is helium-4. This is 87, 86. The thing to remember is this is less depleted. This direction is more depleted. And what you notice is that there's a general covariance between the helium and the strontium ratio. So when you get to low 3-4 ratios, you get to more depleted isotopic compositions. In this case, if you look, when you get to higher 3-4 ratios, you go to less depleted composition. You look at it from the point of view of Mauna Kea, the story is basically the same. Higher 3-4 ratios, which is in red, is correlated with less depleted strontium. So this might be indicating that, again, the high 3-4 ratios are indicative of a less degassed mantle, and which is less processed than the MORB source. So it's consistent with the isotopes as well. Sorry? These fluctuations here? It's believed that, so this is about 3,000 meters depth profile from the HSDP in Mauna Kea. So what this is reflecting is that the proportions of these different mantle components are changing over time. So as the plume is coming up, it might not be a plume that's homogeneous in the Z dimension, that there might actually be variations in the Z dimensions, and or the melting region might be migrating over different regions. So at some time, you might be sampling more of this undegassed material, and at other times, you might be sampling more of the more degassed mantle. So it's just reflecting variations in the proportions of the material that's contributing to the melting. If I translate that into time, it's about 100 years to maybe 1,000 years. I never actually explained that, but there is actually some paleomagnetic data, and I would admit that this is not going to be very strong. But if you take recent variations in the geomagnetic field, and if you map that back into here, you would say that these variations are about 8 times atmospheric, is happening on something like 100 years. So these are fairly rapid. It's not a very slow change. Okay, so again, these are the warmograms that John Eiler mentioned. And I don't know if, again, Stan has a preference for any of these names. I have heard multiple different interpretations. This is what Jason Fitzmorgan calls them. So what we're noticing here is strontium plotted versus helium. So this is high helium, higher the helium, less depleted. And the argument that has been made is that all these different islands seem to be sort of converging on a region in this isotope space, or to a common region in this isotope space. And so FOSO sort of represents this focal zone. And so this is a material that has high helium ratios, but it's depleted with respect to a chondrite in its 87-86. And so you have Samoa mixing with something that is enriched. This might be sediments or might be something else, mixing with this less degassed mantle. Likewise, Galapagos and Hawaii seem to be mixing also with the same component down here. Now, it turns out that in detail, if you look at individual islands, the individual islands actually don't seem to converge to a single point. And I think Matt Jackson also now has data from Samoa which would tend to support that. So if you look at the case, for example, of Hawaii, so this is the most primitive compositions that have been seen at Hawaii is from Lu'ihi. And this is the trend that is seen in lower trend volcanoes. So this would be Lu'ihi, Mauna Loa, Hualalai, and these are Kilauea and Mauna Kea. And they define two different trends. And the interpretation is where you see the intersection of these two different trends is where the plume component is. In reality, Fozo lies way up over here, somewhere up here. You cannot actually take this trend and get up to Fozo in that direction. If you look at Samoa, you would sort of see the same thing, that there are different trends defined by different islands, and they don't go into Fozo. They go into some other place. So what this is what this tells you is that this high 3-4 component probably mixes with something else, and then those two then mix with different regions of the Earth's mantle. And so for each single volcano, you would notice that they're forming different trends and they're not actually going up into where Fozo lies. Well, this is sort of an eyeball, right? You just see these trends and you say, you know, something is going up in this direction, something is going up in this direction. To actually constrain the ratios, this is the wrong plot. So you have to plot helium isotopes the right way. Because here, the mixing trajectories are going to be defined by helium-4 to 86. Helium-4 is not an indicative of primordial concentrations. It's indicative of the amount of uranium and thorium you have in the source. So effectively, when you make these kinds of plots, you're actually looking at uranium plus thorium distortion ratios. So you really have to reverse it. So there is a right way of actually making these plots. If you want to make these mixing calculations quantitatively, you have to know the concentrations of the end members. But these are eyeballs just showing you where those trajectories end up. So, you know, it could actually be something like this. It could be something maybe that's more hyperbolic. But I think the point is that they don't converge to where Fozo is. If it was converging to Fozo, this should actually be showing a slight negative trend here. That, of course, by the way, would define where Fozo lies. But this is actually supported by data that Matt has, that he doesn't seem to be seeing something that goes straight to Fozo. So one can make, again, some very basic inferences based on these relations between helium and the other traces, which is, even though it seems like nothing is mixing directly with Fozo, if you look at the global relationships, it seems like you can explain the helium variations coupled with strontium, neodymium, and I didn't actually show the lead data, that is coming from a reservoir that's relatively well characterized in these isotopic compositions as well. And helium is actually internal to this. So Fozo is actually not an end member in strontium, neodymium, and lead space. And if I go back to the slide where I showed neodymium versus strontium, you would notice that Fozo is actually internal to that array. So to actually pick up Fozo, one really needs to use helium as a tracer. Let me just throw a quick little kink into the idea that MORBs are sampling something that is less degassed. So MORBs are some sampling that is less degassed. And this is something that Don Anderson pointed out about maybe 15 years ago, which is if MORBs are sampling less degassed material, they better have a higher gas concentrations than if OIBs are sampling less degassed material, they better have a higher concentration than MORBs. So what this is showing you is that the helium-3 concentration and the helium-4 concentration plotted against some elemental ratios. And these are MORBs. These are the OIBs. And basically, you notice in both the plots MORBs have higher helium-3 concentrations and they have higher helium-4 concentrations. So for a long time, this was completely ignored by the community, and it was said this is simple degassing trajectories. We know that most OIBs are erupted at shallow depths. If they're erupted at shallow depths, they would have degassed more. MORBs are erupted at average depths of about 4 kilometers. OIBs are erupted at average depths of 1 kilometer. So this is just reflecting the fact that it's degassed. So OIBs are just more, this is superficial degassing and not a reservoir signature. Well, it turns out that this is not really a good explanation for that. So this is plotting helium-3 versus now the 3:20:22 ratios. And helium is more soluble in a basaltic melt than neon, which means when you degas something, the concentration goes down, but the 3:20:22 ratio goes up. So this is supposed to be the degassing trajectory, the expected degassing trajectory. Okay. Sorry. So if you start off with something that has a high gas concentration and you degas it, you don't go down in this direction. You actually go up in this direction. So this was also the argument that Don Anderson used to say you cannot explain this difference in concentrations by a simple degassing. Well, it turns out that you might actually be able to do it because you actually have to make the degassing calculations a little more realistic. And what you really have to do is think about the effects of water and CO2 on how it affects the helium solubilities and the neon solubilities. So this is showing you the solubilities of the noble gases. That's helium, neon, and that's in a system that has no water and CO2. This is the helium and the neon solubilities when there's about 3 weight percent water. Now, I'll agree that this is very unrealistic. You're probably never going to have 3 weight percent water in a basaltic melt. But the point is that you actually change the slopes, and that's what's important. By adding water and CO2 to the system, you will change the relative solubilities of the noble gases, which means that you actually might not be moving in this direction. You can actually be moving down in this direction. And this is some work that Helga Gonerman and I have been doing, and I think we'll have something at this year's AGU, whereby we can actually explain this variation by using simple degassing calculations, whereby we start with a slightly higher helium-3 concentrations in OIBs than in MORBs. And we can explain this system very consistently. So I'm running out of time, so let me just put up the summary statement and instead just entertain questions or any comments that you might have. Okay, so the question is, I made the comment that nothing might be mixing directly with FOSO, but how well is FOSO constrained? FOSO in some respects is a little fuzzy. So it's a fuzzy FOSO. So the highest measured 3:4 ratios now are from the Baffin Island, which is about 50 times atmospheric. So that would be plotting at about here. So as you can see, these arrays are quite far away. And so, you know, there's always going to be some amount of variation in the x dimension as to what the exact composition is. It's going to be very small, but it's still going to be there. The other thing is the highest measured value doesn't have to reflect the exact composition of this undegassed or less degassed material, because you still will have a little bit of MORB addition to it. So it's not clear exactly where it is. It's probably at about 50 times atmospheric ratios, maybe 60 times atmospheric, somewhere between that. So the real FOSO is up here, which is why if you actually make these two plots, it does not go straight. So this is Hawaii, and that's why it won't actually end up at where FOSO is. It'll shoot a little to the left of FOSO unless you make FOSO even more depleted. Maybe that's a possibility. Maybe Stan is going to address that. Which goes up to 37, yeah. I think I agree. I mean, I think So Matt was telling me he was beaten up by people because he claimed that everything was converging to a single point. And he was arguing that in Samoa he sees stuff that's going straight up, that's not going into Fozo. And what I told him is that, you know, you see the same thing at Hawaii, that if you look at individual trends, they might not be going to where Fozo is. But if you look at the global systematics, then everything does seem to be converging to sort of a single area. Now, I'll admit that that is fuzzy. Where exactly it lies is going to be maybe difficult to nail down, but I think one can define broad values for those. Like one can say helium ratios are between 50 to 60, strontium is maybe somewhere between 7028 to 7034, something like that. Mark? Yeah, that's a good point. Yes. So the question is, you know, how well do we really know the potassium content of the bulk earth? And therefore, how confident are we that there is some sort of a layering? And I think, I hope I made this point, that you should not take this as gospel, that this does not include, this does not mean that you have a layering at the 660. What this argument can be used to say is that there might be a reservoir that is more argon-40 rich than the Moab reservoir. And I think Lassiter actually had a very hard time making it go away completely. He had to choose, in some respects, extreme compositions, like he had to have 12% of the crust in the mantle, and you need to have severe fractionations of potassium from uranium in the subduction zone. So he could decrease this a lot, but he could not make it go away completely. So I think that his paper, I think in that respect, was important because it just tells us that there are uncertainties in the potassium content. There's probably a gas-rich reservoir, but that gas-rich reservoir is not equal to the size of the lower mantle. That's right, and I don't believe that half the argon is stuck in the lower mantle. I don't think that half the argon is in the lower mantle. I think that there are really large uncertainties in this 4 to 40 ratio over time, and that there are uncertainties in the potassium content as well to say that this is representing half the argon reservoir. Yeah. Ken. That's right. That's why I'm saying that the argon argument is effectively being tied to the helium 4 flux. So that's the weak link there. And I'm not sure why the helium 4 flux over time has to remain constant. I mean, I think we probably know it to within 20% maybe.